Comic Timing is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 36, part 1 of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Join in as a rotating panel of guests and myself, Ian Levinstein, discuss whatever comes to mind, time after time, here on Comic Timing. On today's episode, we get the independent perspective on things as Dave Wachter of Scar Tissue joins in on an interesting conversation on his career and the world of independent comics. Plus, as usual, plenty of funny anecdotes along the way, because it wouldn't be Comic Timing without at least a little bit of snark. Here now, Comic Timing. Hey there, folks. My name's Ian Levinstein, and welcome to episode 36 of Comic Timing. And we are joined today by the artist of Scar Tissue, and one of the most interesting comics I've read in a while, with a very interesting concept at that. He is Dave Wachter. What's up, Dave?
Hey, everybody.
What's going on, buddy?
Not much. How you doing?
Doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. You recovered from New York Comic Con already?
Oh, yeah.
I'm still feeling it in some aspects. I wanted to come back, man. That was fun. That was enjoyable for everybody. But yeah, what this episode is basically going to focus on is mostly just independence in general, what drove Dave to the independent side in the first place, what it takes to break in, that sort of stuff. And from there, we'll go more into Dave's work. And we might be joined by Steve Bryant later on. It depends on whether or not he's available. If not, then we might have him on a later date. But for now, I guess we'll start with something nice in general. What originally drew you to the world of indie comics?
Gee, I have no idea. I mean, it's just, I like comics, you know? I like comics in general, whether they're indie comics or mainstream big two comics or whatever. I just love everything that comes in that that storytelling format. As for doing indie comics, you know, I saw it as a route to get in, to be able to tell the kind of stories that I want to tell and do the kind of art that I want to do, and as a way to break into the industry in general.
Now, when was the moment when you decided, this is the thing I want to do in my life, this is what I want to do someday, you know, be in the comic book industry?
Originally, I think I was 9, and then I got away from comics for a while, and then a few years ago, I got back into comics, about 2001. I had been out of school for a few years, and I had been doing several different jobs. I started just, you know, I was reading more and more comics. And eventually what actually happened was I had the headmaster of the school that I went to for grade school, from 4th to 8th grade, had contacted me out of the blue through email. And it was pretty amazing. And he just wanted to see what I was up to. He was retired now and everything. And he remembered me and tried to find me on the Internet and wanted to see what I was up to. And he had mentioned that a children's book that I had written and illustrated back when I was in school there, it was probably the 6th, 7th grade, something like that. And he mentioned that I should try to get that published. Well, that book was long gone. I have no idea where it is. And then I started researching things in the children's book industry and doing children's book illustrating. And I thought, you know, this might be fun, but I'm not really into children's books.
Yeah.
You know, I don't read them. I don't have much of an interest in them. And then I started to think, well, what do I really love? You know, well, I love comic books, you know. And by this time, I was probably reading maybe 5 books at the time. You know, I was just getting back in 2001, 2002.
Yeah.
But I was like, this is what I want. This is the kind of art that I love to do. This is the kind of stuff that I love to do as a kid, and this is the kind of stuff that I would love to do again. And so from then on, I just went for it, you know?
It's got to be perfect timing, too, you know? I mean, him contacting you and getting the bug back at right at the same time.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, there's a number of factors. I mean, I also thank my brother for getting me back into it. And I also thank the pharmacy down the street for having a rack full of comics. Because that's really one of the things that got me back into it, is a pharmacy grocery store. And I was shopping, and I saw this rack, and I saw that John Romita Jr. was doing Amazing Spider-Man again.
Oh, yeah.
And so that just took me back, and I had to pick it up. And so that's how I was getting my comics for a good year, was just I was picking up Amazing Spider-Man off of that rack. Then when my brother moved up to Chicago here, he got me for my birthday, he got me a subscription to The Amazing Spider-Man and then Daredevil, and that's when Bendis and Maleev were on it. And I was blown away by that, and that just I got the bug all over again. I started, you know, really getting into comics again, and then I found a local shop, and I started going there every couple of weeks, and now I'm one of the first people there on Wednesdays when they open up, you know, buying way too many comics, you know, but
Well,
that all happened at the same time, and then my old headmaster contacted me, and I got to thinking about what I was doing with my life and what I really, did I just want to be making a living, or did I just want to go for, what I love to do, and so I just went for it.
Well, I actually can relate to the whole drugstore or supermarket thing, because actually when I was first really getting into it, I used to work with my dad over at his dog grooming shop in Queens, and there was a little drugstore down the street where I first started picking up my DC comics, and some of the first comics that I got were right over at that drugstore. So drugstores can be pretty helpful.
Yeah, they sure can. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you're just walking by and you go, hey, look, comic books. I remember those.
Yeah, I actually remember picking up Zero Hour number zero.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, back in the day. And that drugstore was long gone, but luckily my love for comics is not, so I guess it had a lasting appeal for everybody involved there.
Right.
What were some of the first indie comics you read on once you got back into comics?
I think what really helped me get into the indie comics were going to be titles that were coming out through Image, some mm-hmm. of the new titles that were coming out through there.
Yeah.
And the Vertigo titles. I know it's a subset of DC, but really I think it has that indie flavor, and that's what pulled me into that world of hey, look, comic books can tell all sorts of stories and all kinds of genres, and it was something that as a kid, it was just something that never dawned on me. I liked my superhero books growing up, and that's all that I read, and when I started seeing these other kind of stories, I was like, yeah, I like science fiction, I like westerns, I like, all sorts of different kinds of stories in other mediums. Why not in comics? I'll pick them up and try them out, and I love them. I absolutely love them. And I think one of the things that really got me in was that that first issue of 100 Bullets I picked up.
Uh-huh.
It's a Vertigo book. I'd never seen it. It was like issue 50 something, and I picked it up. I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
Which you can read every single issue from number one of 100 Bullets and still not know what's going on. But I picked that up. And I was just, this was amazing. This was, there's no capes. There's just, there's just guys with guns. And there's amazing art. And there's fantastic writing. And I was like, that's something I can get into. Where are more books like this?
Yeah. To this day, I'm happy that I picked up Why the Last Man when I did, because I happened to pick it up on one of the in-between arcs, like one of the throwaway, like two-parters that had a fill-in artist that wasn't mm-hmm. really part of the main story. I believe they were actually hunting, if I remember correctly, it was a theater troupe that had found Yorick's monkey.
Yep.
That was the first arc that I picked up. And right away, I'm like, oh, wow, this is pretty interesting. And then from there, I went backwards and picked up all the, first trades. I was still picking it up monthly and all that, but I filled myself in. And I'm so glad I did, because that was one of the things that really got me into the indie genre in general. And again, like we said, Vertigo is Vertigo, but it still has that indie feel. And it was sort of the gateway drug, as it were, to more indie comics from there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And to this day, I'm kind of glad that Vertigo's around, to say the least.
Oh, absolutely. I love Vertigo books. I mean, they're outstanding. They really are.
Yeah, no question about that. Now, did you find these books on your own, or did you get them through suggestions? And if there were any suggestions, what were they, and were they in the superhero genre or otherwise?
Oh, gosh. I think part of it was finding a local shop and being able to just look around. The shop I go to is great because it's just alphabetical order. They don't divide it up by genre or anything. So.
Yeah.
You can have indie books right next to superhero books, and it's fine. Also, the fact that the people who work at the shop are great, and you tell them, okay, I like this and this. What else might I like? Well, mm-hmm. you might like this, you might like that, and they're able to make really good suggestions.
Yeah.
The fact that trade paperbacks exist helped me out like no other thing, or there's so many things that during the 10, 12 years I was away from comics that I never would have been able to read.
Yeah.
Just having those on the shelf and being able to flip through them and look through and say, I can get a whole, I can get half a year's worth of these and check it out and see if I like it. It's not really that much, and there's no ads. So
exactly.
And then just looking around, I was basically at a time where I felt like a sponge. I was like, I have a few things. I want more. What else is there?
Mm-hmm.
Go on to message boards and find out what other people are reading. Do you read this and this? What else? If you like those things, what else should I read? And that's a great thing about the comics community. You can always find even though indies might be a smaller subset of it, there's still plenty of people out there willing to let you know what's good and what isn't.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, the podcasts are part of that, and just going to the Oracle shop is part of that. And yep. what I love the most about these days, at least, and, I mean, you mentioned the trade paperbacks, the fact that not only do the regular, you know, like bigwigs like DC and Marvel benefit from the trades, but definitely independent books will benefit on that as well. But the problem is finding out whether or not your book is strong enough to even warrant a trade in the first place, because it costs a lot of money to get those trades out there, and you're selling it for cheaper than the individual issues themselves. Do you think indie comics might actually go to a trade format someday as opposed to just the, you know, monthlies? Because I know that there are some out there that just go straight trade in the first place.
Right. Well, that's tough. You know, when you're indies, you're working on a small budget. You know, so can you go 6 months before you even put something out there?
Yeah.
You know, that's really the hard thing. It sounds like a great idea to just go trade with indies sometimes, but yeah, can you work 6 months on something before anyone even sees it and isn't even able to tell you if it's any good or not, or if it's even going to sell or not?
Yeah.
That's an advantage that monthlies have that you can't really replace with that. Of course, then you get the shelf life with trades that you don't get with monthlies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's always that trade-off. So who knows? I mean, it could go all the way to trades, but I don't know. I don't see it happening right away. I mean, I know there's plenty of people who still like to put them out monthly, and there's just logistical reasons that, yeah, you kind of have to do it that way.
Exactly. And it's sort of a double-edged sword, too. If you happen to be one of the people who puts out their book monthly and then all of a sudden, you know, misses a month or misses 2 months, misses 3 months, all of a sudden people are forgetting that you exist. But then again, the same thing could be said for the trade, because if you put out one trade every 6 months, then it's going to be difficult to garner up the sort of attraction you might have if you've got individual issues that people can pick up.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and it is the medium is so that, you know, it's continuation stories. You know, they're periodicals. They keep coming out, and you keep getting them. It's not like a novel where you have one, and it's all wrapped up, and maybe a year from now they'll come out with another book that has that character, but it's a completely different story.
Yeah.
You know, it's comics are its own periodic medium, and you got to weigh that into account.
Definitely. No question about that. And, I mean, the bookstores help in all that in some aspects because, you know, you do have them sitting on the shelves. But, again, how long do they sit on the shelves before they get into people's hands?
Right.
Yeah. So you got to weigh that out in every single aspect there. What do you feel about the state of the indie market now? Because obviously there is a bit of a resurgence going on. I mean, you do have a lot of the small publishers back in the limelight now. I mean, say back in the 90s, it was all, you know, it was like Image or nothing in many aspects. Before then, you had plenty of small indies, but then they all sort of washed up, and then the 90s basically ate everybody up. But now we're sort of going to a return of indie comics. Do you see them surging forward any farther than they already are? I mean, what do you feel the current state of indie comics is?
You know, I hope they just keep on going. I mean, that's my hope. What do I see realistically? I think indie comics can help expand the market, you know, in a way that mainstream comics maybe don't. They can get a different kind of reader in to comic books who maybe didn't read comics before. So indies can help expand the market as a whole and bring more people in. And, you know, right now it looks like everything's going, I mean, I just see it going, getting better and better. Whether that'll plateau, you know, it'll reach a saturation point. I mean, there are a lot of titles out right now, and there's, you know, a lot of it's good and a lot of it's not good. So, you know, the more stuff you have out, logic would seem to dictate that there's going to be more good stuff for people to find, but they have to wade through a lot of the bad stuff to get there. I mean, who knows? You know, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not an expert, really. I'm just a peon in this game.
Yeah.
And just, you know.
Well, if either one of us had a crystal ball, we'd be richer men right now, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That much can be said. Now, with the indies, and again, you mentioned before the fact that there are so many different things other than superhero comics out there. That's one thing that indie comics definitely have over DC and Marvel, that the fact that DC and Marvel basically are just superheroes. I mean, you'll get different aspects of it. You'll get, like, maybe the covert ops, that sort of stuff. But it's almost always going to just be superheroes with them. Within the comics, you could have, you know, if somebody is into horror, you've got the horror books. If you've got, you know, adventure, you've got adventure books. While that's not something you really get with the big two. And I feel that that's definitely part of the appeal to indie comics in the first place. And that's another reason why I feel that they've been resurging, because there's been great content in every one of those genres. You just got to go out there and find it yourself.
Yeah, and I think the audience is getting older and more mature over the years, you know, and they're just looking for new things. Most of us still want our great superhero stories that come from the big two, but we also, you know, we want variety. It's just something that comes along with getting older and more mature and, when, you know, not wanting to see the same thing over and over again or like that. And this is coming from a guy whose indie book actually is superheroes.
Yeah.
But that's the great thing about indie is you can do superheroes too. I mean,
oh, sure, yeah.
You know, there are plenty of those people who are out there who will say, well, I don't want to read an indie superhero book because the big two, they have that market cornered. But not really, because there's always a different kind of story that can be told.
Oh, sure, yeah. And I mean, your story in general is not something that I've ever really seen out of the big two. So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's good for us, I guess.
Yes, indeed. Now, Scar Tissue shows up in previews when it's listed?
No, Scar Tissue is not solicited through previews.
Okay.
We're totally indie with that one.
Ooh la la. Well, that's
previews say no.
That's one of the problems, though, the fact that previews sort of engulfs the industry, as it were. You know.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, they're the only game in town, you know, for wide range comic book distribution. I think that's one way that independence can also be extending the market is the necessity of finding new ways to get the book out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's the book market or whether it's online and web comics or distributing that in, you know, PDFs or whatever. Just out of pure necessity, you know. It's the mother of invention.
It certainly is at that. And the one problem, though, is that, and again, this is something that was brought up very recently, with the fact that with that Marcosia has now changed their name to get to the front of the book.
Right.
It's hard to actually be, you know, say a company that starts with a Z and actually get anybody to flip through that ginormous thing and get every single name. You know, you got to have a lot of patience to flip all the way through previews.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're right. You know, what's the key? What's the key to getting somebody's attention? Who knows? You know, maybe that's why you got to find other ways to grab the people's attention that's outside of previews, maybe even outside of the comic book shop.
Yeah, well, how have you been advertising your book? I mean, obviously, you know, without previews, it's kind of difficult to get, you know, the full range of the advertisement that you would get. But what methods have you been using to advertise Scar Tissue out there?
It's called hustling. You know, you just get out there and you just yell from the rooftops about your book. You know, online, of course. I mean, the internet is something that wouldn't even have been, you know, years ago. You couldn't do anything. You know, it wasn't around.
Yeah.
And now suddenly we have this all completely new medium, which is you can't go that way alone. That's one more facet to the way that you go about it. So internet, being a part of the comic book community, you know, just being on forums and being in touch with other, you know, we're all fans too. All the creators are fans. So being in touch with other fans and other creators and being able to get the word out that way. Let's see, what else do we do? There's this thing called podcasting now.
Ooh.
That I've heard of. Yeah, have you heard of it?
No, not really.
It's like radio, but it's it doesn't suck.
You put that on your iPod, right?
The iPod. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Apple iPod.
Yeah.
And so that way, I that's been a really nice boon for us getting out onto the different, because people can hear your voice and hey, this is a real person, and they can hear it and be able to look for it themselves. You just try to find any method you can, you know, whether it's an online distributor, whether it's an online store where they can purchase your book, or whether it's putting in a PDF format and trying to circulate things out that way. Trying to think of what other ways that we've done it, but not popping in my head right now.
So
conventions, of course. What am I thinking? Conventions.
Yeah.
Getting out there and meeting face-to-face with people and being able to have your book, being able to stand behind your book and tell people about it and, you know, have them buy it straight from you. And that's been a big way for us, too. Really, you know, it's not a indie comics, it's not a profit-making machine. You know, you're doing it because you love to do it and you want to get it out to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not making any money off of it, so you can't think of it as a profit-loss kind of thing. Is it worth going to a convention if it costs that much money? Well, you know, it's worth it in intangible ways or ways that don't rack up monetarily, maybe.
Well, out of the cost it takes to go to the convention, how much is made up of it with sales?
Not much.
Okay.
Really. Because sales, at least for us, I can talk about scar tissue, is that for us, you know, we sell a book, the money from that book goes back to printing more books.
Okay.
You know, and especially for us, since we are self-published and we do print-on-demand printing.
Okay.
Which is, so we can print up one copy or 100 copies or 1,000 copies. And it's always the same flat rate per copy, but that flat rate per copy is going to be a lot higher than, say, if we got 5,000 copies at a time from
yeah.
a big printer.
Yeah.
So it does cost a lot more for us to print up these books. So when we sell the book, you know, that's paying for it being printed in itself, and then the rest of the money goes just straight back to the printer.
Now you guys are published by Ronin, correct? That's the...
Not anymore.
Not anymore?
Not anymore. Yeah, now we're with, we weren't actually, you know, we're self-published.
Yeah.
So we actually published ourselves, even when we were with Ronin, that's a studio that we were just together with. Some of us broke off from Ronin and started our own studio called Dial R Studio.
Okay.
And it's myself, Pat Loika, Tim Loika, Chris Mays, and Jim Clark, who, of course, writes Scar Tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of other people who will be pissed that I'm not mentioning them right now. But a smaller group that broke off, basically formed our own studio, and it's just a way for us to be able to pool resources and pool ideas together for promoting, and then we each publish our own books, you know, with complete freedom to do it whatever way we want to.
So you're not bogged down by anybody else now. You can do whatever you want, basically.
Right. Of course, we've got nobody paying any of our bills, but that's the trade-off.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? But but at the same time, the fact that you do get to print up, you know, whatever sells is a good thing. I mean, you're not left with any extra copies.
Right. Exactly. I got nothing to add to that.
Good. Good to hear. We haven't actually discussed scar tissue to a degree so far, and obviously there are probably people out there who are like, what the hell is a scar tissue thing? You want to give people a quick summary on what scar tissue is?
Sure. Scar tissue is the story of a teenage boy who, having suffered all his life from a congenital heart defect, he gets a heart transplant. And it turns out that this heart comes from a murdered supervillain, and that's the pitch.
Dang.
So basically we follow young Ben Foray as he starts to find strange things happening to him as a result. And, of course, there are going to be people who want what he has. And that's it.
Which has definitely been the case. And, I mean, from the issues that I have, which is, well, all of them so far, I've very much been enjoying the series, and I hope that other people out there go out and buy it as well. Yes, that would be very good. Give him money, folks. That would be very, very good. What was the process before you actually came out to number one? How long did it take you to actually, you know, format the theory of scar tissue before you actually sat down, wrote the issue, draw the issue, obviously in tandem with the other creators of the book? But how long was it before issue one actually saw fruition?
Let's see. From the time I would say that I met Jim Clark, he's the writer. He's the guy who had the original idea and wrote and writes the stories.
Yeah.
Now, I met him... by us coming together at Ronin, you know, somebody from Ronin suggested that I come over and and read some scripts, and I read his script, and then we met each other virtually online. And then we got basically to work. He had the script ready, and I started designing characters and went straight into doing the pages. And I think, you know, it was probably a couple of months, you know, as he was tweaking the script, and I was, I'd say it's probably 3 months before the first issue came out.
Okay.
Well, plus 3 months before we had it done, and then there was another lag time for the printer for about a month. So from the time we first probably met and formulating all the original imagery and everything like that, probably 4 months before issue one came out.
So it could be a long-term process, to say the least.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, you know, with indie books, you're also dealing with people who've got to, you know, we got to work for a living, too. You know, this is something that we have to do in the hours between doing other things. And the production schedule is going to be a bit slower than, say, a mainstream book. Also, the fact that I do pencils, inks, and grayscales, and I do two different covers for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to make it more of a long-term thing. I mean, we're just working on I'm finishing up issue five right now, so.
Well, which is certainly better than, you know, say, just throwing something out there. I mean, you're putting all the bells and whistles on it first before actually putting a product out there, which is, you know, it shows. It definitely does. I mean, the fact that it takes a bit longer than, say, a monthly book, to me, the trade-off is almost negligible there. I mean, you're getting as good a quality product there as you would get elsewhere, and that's what's important, really.
Yeah, and most of our issues have a few more pages than a regular book. I mean, this last issue that I'm working on is 36 pages long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You tell me about it, please. And I got that script. I was like, hello. Mm-hmm. But... Yeah, and it's also, I mean, this is the first series I've ever worked on, so this is a whole learning process for me, where, you know, both Jim and I are first-time comic creators, so we're figuring out how the whole thing works.
Uh-huh.
So, and I think that might be the way with a lot of indie people. It's like, you know, these are early-time creators, they're working full-time jobs on the side, and, you know, it's something that I think that the indie audience understands is that it might take a little bit longer for a book to come out because, you know, this is it's a different process than a mainstream book, you know?
Yeah, I mean, as opposed to having an entire office behind you, you've got, like, three people.
Right.
Which is certainly a major difference there. How odd is it to never meet somebody before? Obviously, I'm sure you probably met him by now, right? I mean, or are you still just associating solely through the internet? I mean, how
odd? I met...
Okay.
Jim and I had been working together online for roughly a year before we met. We actually met at the first time we did the San Diego Comic-Con. I guess it was 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
2000 and whatever, and 2005, I think, San Diego Comic-Con was the first time we met.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, it's the way it works now, you know, this is it's a global economy, you know, it's telecommuting. There are advantages and disadvantages. Advantages are is that you can pull from, now you can communicate with anyone around the world.
Yeah.
Disadvantages is that you can't be in a room together just, you know, discussing things in a way where you can, you know, where you can use your hand movements to show somebody what you're talking about, you know, or you can't say, see over on this page, you have to, you know, describe it in an email.
Yeah.
Or over the phone or something, but mostly through email because phone calls are expensive. But, you know, over emails and things like that, you have to be able to, you have a narrower way in which to communicate. You can't use your, you know, all the other ways that you can communicate to a person face-to-face, you no longer have that. So that can be tough and it can be frustrating, you know. Trying to get an idea, a creative idea across through an email can sometimes be very difficult. But you got to figure out a way to do it, you know. It's these kind of challenges that, you know, hopefully will make you stronger and help you be able to communicate better down the road.
Well, it's certainly interesting. That's one of the main ways that the independent scene has changed over the years, that the fact that more and more now there could be creators working together that have never met before in real life. You know, they're completely just talking over the phone and over the internet. I mean, sure, they might do a vid chat every now and then. They might know what each other looks like. But actually, you know, shaking somebody's hand might be far down the horizon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you can do that around the world. I mean, you can have people who, you know, there are lots of artists I know in South America now and in Europe now that are able to communicate across these borders and through the air. But there's still, you know, and there's still something to be said, though, for being able to meet somebody face-to-face. I mean, that's the kind of experience that I hope we don't lose. I hope we can still have that to some extent, and that the telecommuting and the internet stuff doesn't completely cut us off from the physical interaction, because I know that when I met Jim, it was like, wow, look, you know, I had a completely different experience with this person, being able to see them face-to-face and have dinner with them and talk over things. And the amount of information we were able to convey over dinner could take days over the internet. I mean, you think the internet speeds it up, but you sit down at dinner with somebody and you just start talking about things, and how much gets passed back and forth can be so much more all of a sudden. And it's just like, wow, you know, you wish that you could, you know, at least I do. I wish that everyone I work with could, I could be in the physical presence of. And I really think that it's easier that way, and that there are so many more advantages that way.
Well, if there's one thing you really got to hope for when you meet somebody for the first time in real life, is the food better be damn good.
Oh, yeah. And who's buying?
Oh, yeah. That could definitely be as important. But it's changed things, and at the same time, I think it's sort of like an evolution, you know, of the indie scene along with, you know, the world. Because if people were just still creating only if they could meet somebody in real life, well, then there'd be a lot less comics out there. And it's just all part of the growth experience of the industry and of ourselves in general. We got to, you know, adapt to this new technology. And if it helps people converse, then by all means, go for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the way humans interact and communicate has changed more in the past couple of decades probably than ever before. And at a faster rate. So I just hope that we can always use it responsibly and use it well.
Just like drinking, got to use it responsibly.
Yeah. Well,
most of the time.
Yeah, I guess so.
Most of the time. Exactly, yeah.
Most of the time. It's fun to be irresponsible once in a while, you know?
Both in the internet and drinking. But that's another, another story for another time.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Now, I know that you do sketches. Obviously, I know that you do sketches because you did one for me, too. How often is it a superhero sketch, and how often is it, say, a character that might be a little more obscure, as it were, say, an indie character?
I would say it's 99.9% a superhero sketch.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people want, and I like doing them, which is cool, you know. Any other time, it's, I'm trying to think of anything else that I haven't, not too many other things. You know, I've had a couple of people want me to do sketches of maybe a character from Scar Tissue, or it's like Cass and Jess from Preacher. You know, that's not that obscure. But that's mostly what it'll be if it's not a straight up big two superhero guy.
Definitely. And, I mean, do you see yourself, obviously, for most independent artists and for creators in general, it's not the day job, but it's a job. Do you see this someday becoming your day job? Obviously, you know, just devoting yourself, entirely to the art. Now, obviously, that's long down the road. I mean, this is your first project. But do you hope to someday make this a living, a career, a full career?
Yes. That is what, that's my plan. I mean, that's what I'm working towards, is that I can do this, you know, and not have to have another job or any other kind of means of income other than comic book related art. That's what I want to do. That's the plan. And that's what I've been building towards, and hopefully I'll be able to do that sooner than later. Until then, I'll hone my craft and practice.
Now, is scar tissue limited? Is there just one arc here, or is there going to be more scar tissue in the future?
That kind of depends on how the fates treat us. After issue 5, that'll be the first story arc, and then we'll bind it up in a trade. We are going to be taking the trade paperback to publishers and see if anybody wants to pick it up, and from then we'll see. There's really no guarantee one way or the other.
And how difficult is it? I mean, obviously there is difficulty to it, but how difficult is it to find a publisher out there that's willing to publish your work?
I'll let you know when I find one. No, it's tough. It's tough. That's a hard part of the game, and it takes a lot of time. And I know, it's something that sort of drives me crazy. It's like the time I'm spending on doing that, I'd probably rather be drawing, but it's something you got to do. It's part of the business, especially when you're creating. You get your own creator, own title, and if you want somebody to pick that up. But it's like a job interview. You know, every time you're putting that thing up there in front of somebody, you want it to be the best example of your work that you can show. You want to be as professional as possible. You want to show that you're confident in your work, and you just want to bring them your best. And you hope, and then there's a lot of chance, It's like you take it to one editor who hates it, you take it to another editor, and they love it. You just hope that a lot of it falls upon taste. I mean, it's a creative field, so all the creative fields are tough. And the publishers want something that's going to be good for them, and they want something, they want to see things. There's a lot of things for them to look at. I mean, they're constantly looking through different things. So they're going to want to see a project that is the best that they can see. They don't want to see a project that's better than the worst thing that they currently publish. They're not interested in that. They want something that's better than the best thing that they publish. So, you just got to hone your craft, put a smile on your face, be excited about what you're doing, and just keep pushing. Go out there and keep showing it and getting it out there so that people see it. That's one big thing. People have to see it to know that you're out there trying to get them. Otherwise, it could be the best thing in the world, but if nobody sees it, they're never going to know.
Oh, yeah. Now that Mona Lisa 2 is sitting in somebody's closet somewhere.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you gotta know that you've got Mona Lisa 2 in your, that you've created that, and you've got to sort of put aside some of the humility and say, I have created the Mona Lisa 2.
Mona Lisa 2, Electric Boogaloo, coming soon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, right. But, no, and also, I mean, it's important to realize that shopping isn't just for the supermarket. I mean, shop yourself around. It's as important to, get yourself out there to a lot of people as it is to say, just pitch a very important pitch to one person. Because if that very important person says, I'm sorry, we're not interested, and you don't have a plan for the next person, then what the hell are you going to do? You're just going to sit on your ass. Not much you're going to be able to do about it.
Yeah, you got to take it to everybody. I mean, you take it to everybody. You never know from what corner that somebody might pop up and go, we can offer you this. You just don't know. You just got to keep hustling.
How tight-knit of the community is the independent community? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of folks out there, but, I mean, has there been anybody you've been able to turn to for advice? Do you guys, go out to dinner regularly? I mean, I know that you're that the whole Chicago scene and all that are pretty tight-knit, but how tight-knit is the indie scene from what you've seen so far?
It's a great community. I mean, there's different pockets of it, and, different people know different people, but I'm amazed at how many people that I meet at a convention or that I see over and over and over, we're able to exchange ideas and you form a group around yourself and you make sort of a tight little ball of a community. And then you take your little segment and you go out into a larger community as a larger voice. But no, I've found that it's a very positive community. People aren't really worried about, this guy's going to take my job. There's no sense of that whatsoever. Everybody wants to see what everybody else is up to and willing to give advice. So it's a great community, and I'm just happy to just be one little guy in it and And this is why I want to make this Dylan Comics my... One of the reasons I want to make comics my life, it's not just because I love drawing, but it's because of the community that's around it, both the professional community and the fan community. It's like no other place. There is no other industry like this.
Anybody who even just reads comics knows that the industry is just something that really it pales in comparison to plenty of other careers. You know, I mean, there's certain careers where, you know, you're sitting there and you're just on your butt all day and you're not really enjoying yourself. But the fact is, afterwards, you know, are you going to be hanging out with these people?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you get to do with the comic community that you would not be able to do in, say, you know, like the paper publishing business. You know,
Dunder Mifflin.
Yeah. But you get the idea. The fact is, I mean, even just from being a podcaster, I've realized this. Just hanging out with folks, you can hang out with people here, as opposed to, you know, just having to, you know, that there's always going to be somebody out there to hang out with, which is definitely a plus, to say the
least.
Absolutely. Yeah. Something that I asked to Steve in the Forever Lost episode of Comic Timing I'll Never Get Back what character you'd like to see yourself doing down the road that is big too? As an independent guy, what would you like to see yourself doing someday in the big two?
Well, you know, I just have to go with one of my favorite characters, and I'd have to say probably Daredevil.
Okay.
You know, I've loved this book since the 80s. I love what's going on with it now. You're able to explore so many different things, I think, with that title.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a superhero book, but it's also a very... it's a crime book, and it's very street level, and I like street level. You know, I like street scenes, and I like the cracks in the brick, and I like the shadows, and, you know, people coming out of the shadows, and subtleties of expression and emotions, and then you also get to do a guy in tights dressed up like the devil jumping around beating the crap out of somebody, and that's just fun, you know?
Oh, man, it's fun to read and it's fun to look at, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Any creators that you yourself would drool over the opportunity to work with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many people that I'm loving right now that to even start on that list would probably be dangerous because I'd probably never stop. You know, I'm loving like Brian K. Vaughan. I mean, he's an amazing writer, right? I think I love everything that the guy's done so far.
Yeah.
Brubaker is an incredible writer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and who is Brian Wood with some of the stuff he's doing? That you know, it's still indie, but it's one of these crossover kind of guys.
Yeah.
A new guy to the scene. Who's got a couple of Vertigo books now is Jason Aaron, who did The Other Side, which was the Vietnam book, and now he's got Scalp.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've barely read any of the guy's stuff, but it's amazing, you know, this new stuff that he's got coming out.
Yeah.
So, guys like that. But there's always, you know, there's always something I'm picking up, and I'm going, wow, that's pretty amazing, and what would it be like to work with that person? You know, there's always... You know, you always think in the back of your head, what would it be like to work with Warren Ellis, you know, or what would it be like to work with one of these, you know, classic writers that you've grown up with or something like that. And
yeah.
What's it like to work with that person?
Working with Warren Ellis is a whole different story.
I
have a feeling that would probably be an experience. Well, just from the people who have talked about working with him, it's simultaneously the most insane and awesome experience of your life, probably.
Yeah, see? That sounds great.
I think we'd all want to have that at least one point in our existence, yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the last things I want to ask you is, where do you draw your inspiration? I mean, what artists probably inspire you the most in what you draw?
I mean, there's the guys that I grew up on that I love so much that I first noticed, like John Romita Jr., you know, Art Adams, guys, you know, the first ones that I was able to say, that I was able to recognize from book to book and that I actually made a note of their name in my head, like Barry Windsor Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I mean, it seems like... Everything I see has got some sort of influence. You know, One of the guys I'm loving right now is Tommy Lee Edwards, who just did the Bullet Point series.
Uh-huh.
And I look at what he's doing, and I think, you know, it's a lot different from what I'm doing. You know, he's using a lot of brushwork, whereas I use a lot of pen work.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, well, how can I get some of the movement and the motion of his brushes into my work? And do I want to pick up more brushes and do more brushwork and see what I can do with that? And, a lot of the classic stuff I've been going back to, you know, things that maybe I missed when I was younger or I just didn't appreciate, like Will Eisner. You know, as a kid, I hardly ever saw any of his work or could appreciate what he was doing. And,
yeah.
And only recently have I gone back and started picking these things up and going, that's incredible.
Sure.
You know, I think it takes a certain, you know, now that I'm at a certain age and a certain maturity that I can really get what's going on there. Even guys like Dave Sim, you know, I only started reading Cerebus just a little while ago, and I was just completely blown away by the look of it.
I have to get me some Cerebus trades.
I've
always, you know, everybody keeps telling me, you know, wow, it's one of the best things that they've ever read. And I'm like, well, I definitely have to do that eventually.
It's outstanding. You know, it's like Conan meets Bloom County, you know. It's got that adventure, but it's also got the political bent to it, and just insanely outrageous characters that are all pulled from famous people through history, it's outstanding.
And that in general, come on, Conan meets Bloom County. How could you not be intrigued by that?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Now, I know that you've worked in color and in black and white, and again, we touched on this ever so quickly with the short interview I did at New York Comic Con, but what do you prefer? I mean, what do you think your art stands out with more, whether it be the color or the black and white? Because, you know, as an artist, obviously, you got to have your preferences, and I know that you said that the color sells better, but what is your personal preference for your art, black and white or color?
Oh, that's a toughie. I mean, I really look at it as what's going to tell that story better.
Okay.
You know, Scar Tissue is a superhero book. It's got to be color, right?
Yeah.
But I also really like black and white. And I actually do, you know, for Scar Tissue, I do it all in black and white. And I even do grayscales and then send it off to my brother who does colors.
Yeah.
So, you know, I look at it in black and white and I'm like, wow, that's really cool. I would like to do maybe like a noir story that's all in black and white, and that would look really cool. And then I would, you know, maybe I would change my style a little bit, knowing whether it's going to be, if I know it's going to end up in black and white, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to make different decisions.
Yeah.
You know, I love black and white stuff, and I love color stuff, and you can't make me choose. You can't do it.
okay.
Because I do, you know, because I do the covers and stuff, and those, most of those are, you know, all those are in color, and I do the color myself there.
Yeah, yeah.
And whether they're painted, and I love doing that. And I've been looking at people. I was just looking at, you know, the way color was done and the way Tommy Lee Edwards, I don't know if he's coloring it himself or someone else is coloring in that Bullet Point series. I was looking at how the color was used.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it just blew me away. I thought it was amazing, you know, and it was, in some ways, down to earth, but in other ways, just so design oriented and
exactly
so out
what
there.
I was about to say. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Because it's not the sort of colors that stand out to you, but it's the sort of colors that feel very real.
Yeah,
yeah. Which is again not something you see in superhero comics very often.
Right. Yeah. And I was just looking at the last couple of issues of Jonah Hex, who was doing that. Phil Noto.
Okay.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I think Noto? So. Yeah. Something like that.
And I think he's doing all the art there because it's so integral the way he's doing color there, just to play with the mood and make it almost sort of like a painting at the same time. And I've been looking at these things, and I've been thinking that it would be a lot of fun if I could do some colors on things,
yeah.
You know, in sequential work. Right now I just go up to the grayscale and then I pass it off. Except for a few pages. I do, in Scar Tissue, I've done a couple of flashback scenes where I did the color, and there's a flashback scene in this latest issue of 6 pages where I did the color, which is to give it a different look than the rest, so you know it's a flashback.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a lot of fun doing that, and I was able to turn out the color so much faster than, you know, than doing pencils and inks.
Sure.
And then you do the color on top of it, and you're amazed at, like, wow, I can't believe I did the color, and I did that page in an hour. Wow.
It's like, damn, wow. Yeah. But that's actually one of the things that makes your book stand out is the fact that you do offer the color version, because I've read many an independent book where I've just been thinking the entire time, what would this look like in color? There's certain ones that I wouldn't want to see in color, but then there's the ones that just really needed it, but they couldn't do it due to costs or just due to the fact that their publisher said, you're stuck with black and white, you know, deal with it. But
right.
the fact that you get such a very different feel with this, it's almost like a step above, if that makes any sense. You know, that you're not, quote unquote, stuck with the black and white. You can look at the black and white and enjoy it for what it is, and then you can look at the color and enjoy it for what it is. And you're not left wondering, what would this look like? You get both options.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something we bit the financial bullet and said, you know, we want this to be in color.
Yeah.
So let's just do it, you know.
And it was
worth it. Got to be done.
Yeah, to me, it's definitely worth it because, again, like I said, the combination also, I mean, and those covers, dude, I got to give you props on the covers, man. I mean, every one of those painted covers, you know, the it's like one after the other, they stand out so much. And how different of a style do you use on those than you do on your own art? I mean, is it just the coloring that makes it look so different, or is it just do you go into that with a different idea than the actual interiors?
Well, for the covers, yeah, I do them completely digitally.
Okay.
Now I don't even sketch things out mm-hmm. with the pencils for the covers.
Okay.
And I think if I build them up more like a painting, which is a different process.
Yeah.
I'm trained also as a painter, so it's really a different process than drawing and then inking. I build up a lot of layers with it. I'm working totally in Photoshop with my little pen tablet, you know, and building up the colors. It's using different skills, different part of the brain, a little bit that I'm able to exercise that maybe I don't exercise as much as when I'm doing the interiors.
Mm-hmm.
Just gives me a chance to do something a little different and something that's more, you know, it's like a painting. It's, you know, I want to make something that looks like it could potentially be framed, hung up on the wall. And also, all of those, at least with the color versions, all the covers have a source back to something else. They're all an homage to someone else's work, to mm-hmm. some other piece of work that means that, I think, not only changes the way in which I go about making the cover and the process, but I think also, at least what I'm trying to do is add another meaning on top of it so that a person who is either familiar with the original work that it comes from, or they can go back and explore that, and that will add a little bit more to it.
So it's stretching your artistic legs, to say the least.
Yeah, trying to. Sometimes I wish that I painted them with regular paints, though, you know, bust out the oils again. I haven't had my old paints out in years, but I just know that that would take forever, and it's a little messy. Because it would be nice to have the physical object again.
Yeah.
It is something I miss, being able to have that painting in front of me. And then potentially making a little money selling that, you know. An original piece of art goes for a lot more than a print. Created digitally, but you have to work within the constraints and confines of the clock, basically.
Well, how much has digital changed things for you? I mean, obviously, with technology these days, I mean, like you said, I mean, you don't even have to sketch things out first. You can just go and do it all on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how different is it, really, to do it on digital as opposed to actually painting it yourself?
It's in some ways, it's completely different.
Okay.
And in other ways, it's exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
is that vague enough for you?
I'd say so, yeah.
The process I use is that I when I paint it, I try to paint it as if I were painting with real paints.
Okay.
You know, I try to build up the layers in the same way, and I try to use my brush stroke the same way,
mm-hmm.
but I can do it faster.
Yeah.
I can copy a layer and change it, and if I don't like it, I can toss it out and go back to the old. Mm-hmm. I can, you know, it opens up many more doors that way in which I can alter things. You know, when you do a painting, you've got your work there, and I used to work in oil paints all the time, which means that you can change something and make it completely different, and if you don't like it, you can paint over it again and then paint it back the way it was.
Yeah.
On the computer, you can just say, you can have something one way, and then you can change it, and if you don't like it, you just throw it away, and you're right back to where you wanted it to be without having to go through the process of creating it once again.
Exactly, yeah.
I think there's also a sort of an interchange that goes on, you know, within me in the process of when I paint, it's just there's a different kind of mental process going on when I'm physically painting something. And also there's a different physical process, too, where I'm standing up. I usually stand while I paint. I will paint for a while and then stand back and just stare at it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the computer, you're sitting down and you're staring at a screen, and that can be kind of a pain in the butt. But
yeah.
you can turn on the overhead lights in the apartment, and it doesn't totally change things. You know, when you're working on a painting and you're using natural light out of the window, and then it gets dark out, and you turn the lights on, and it's like, oh, geez, what the heck just happened here?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's just different. There's a lot of things different about it, and there's pros and cons on both sides, and I think there are certain necessities though that make it so that I have to work on the computer.
Well, just as long as you don't turn the brightness up on the monitor, then you're good.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you have to because you know the window comes in, you get some glare.
Uh huh. Oh man. Hey, well, also, if there's one thing that the computers do for people like myself who have absolutely no artistic ability, it can make you feel as if you have artistic ability for at least 5 minutes. You
know,
when you're altering a photo or something like that, or when you're creating an animated GIF, you're like, oh, yeah, wow, that was pretty easy. But God forbid you use your hands for something. Because, oh, my God, I can barely draw a Russian stick figure.
Well, you know what? Go to art school,
uh-huh.
And you'll be right at home.
There you go.
Most of those people really, you know, can't draw a stick figure either. But it's just a matter of tools. What tools help you get to where you want to go?
Yeah. Well, hey, I just like to think that my artistic ability went to my voice and not to my hands. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all good. I was never good at sports when I was a kid, but I do have the voice chops, so that's what matters.
Well, there you go.
Well, dude, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and it was definitely a pleasure having the interview here with you, and also talking about indie comics in general, just to have that going here. And obviously, you can find your stuff at scartissue-comic.com, correct?
Yeah, that's where you can find out about Scar Tissue, or you can go to my personal website, davedrawscomics.com.
Awesome. Sweet.
And then I'm on Comic Space and MySpace and Stupid Space and Space Space.
Well,
all that junk.
You're up in space? How's Mars?
It's cold this time of year.
Yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, luckily those Martian supplies blankets, so it's all good.
Yeah, well, they like to knit.
Oh, man. Hey, is that Raven sketch up on your site yet? Or
I haven't updated the sketches on the site in a while.
Awesome.
So, no, it isn't.
Okay. Well, if anybody does want to take a look at his work, it's up on my Flickr, which actually you can get to by going to speakgeekspeak.com/comic timing. I have a feed of it on the Comic Timing page. So if you want to check it out, it's on there. It's also on
Sketch Gallery.
There you go, comicsketchgallery.com. Thank you very much, which is a great resource. I mean,
yes.
Brian set up some great stuff there, and it's great being able to see everybody's work right there at your fingertips.
It's very cool. I'm really enjoying that site. I go to it every day and just check out what the new stuff is that people are putting up.
Yeah, and the tag tags are definitely fun too, because again, if you want to look at one artist, just search for one artist. It's all good.
Yeah.
It's a virtual museum right at your fingertips. And before we wrap this episode up, let me just give you guys a quick update on what is upcoming. Obviously, this is episode 36, part 1. Now, I teased at one point that Steve Bryant might be joining us, and, well, actually, he ended up joining me a couple of days later for a in-depth discussion. It was actually that next week, and as well, Brent Cassina joined me for that. We were on forever. We were on for 3 hours, basically, and I'm going to split that up into two parts as we went into two pretty interesting conversations as time went on. So part one of that will hopefully be released sometime this upcoming week, and part two will probably be released the time after that. And some upcoming topics to look forward to, obviously, the 22 pages number one with Nova will be coming up probably in about 3 weeks or so. So all of you DCBS guys will be able to get your Nova number one in your shipments before we actually discuss it. And also, we're going to be having an episode on religion coming up as part of our anniversary episode, and a couple of other surprises along the way. So definitely plenty of stuff to come with Comic Timing. And the religion episode is actually the contest winner. So once Titans Together actually gives me his plans and all the information on when he's available, well, then that's when we'll have him on the show. So again, listener participation is wonderful, and I thank everybody for their support for the show, and I thank everybody for hanging back there as I fought off this cold, and hopefully now we'll get back to regular Comic Timing action weekly as always. So again, thanks for hanging in there, and let's wrap up the show.
Yeah, but once again, Dave, dude, always a pleasure, man, and great having you on the show, and would definitely love to have you back in the future.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds good. Listen, thanks a lot. I had a lot of fun.
All right, man, definitely. And let me wrap up the show here while Dave's still on the phone. The email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the forums over at cgspodcast.com/forum, which are graciously hosted by the Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. The links are in the show notes and on the main page. And please review us on iTunes. That would be graciously appreciated as well. And dig.com. Dig us over there, and we're proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. So for Dave Wachter, I'm Ian Levenstein, reminding everybody that there's always time for comics. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next time. And now, some leftover bloopers from episode 35, because I don't have any bloopers from this one. Most specifically, the reaction from the group when I played them the Altered 300 trailer. Enjoy!
Guest star independence.
Oh my god. Hey, kiddies.
Every episode, he has to make an appearance.
Dude, you know he will. Holy shit.
Oh my god.
So, how was it?
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay, good.
Good.
Good, I'm glad. Because that's what I was working on for the last half hour.
Okay. It's a little.
Is that where you went?
It's a whole movie cutting up pieces.
Yeah. Well, no. I wanted it to be long because I wanted it to feel like an actual trailer.
Okay.
Did you just take the audio from the trailer and overdo some of it?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. I took the audio from the YouTube trailer and just overdubbed it. Cracking up the entire time, mind you.
Yeah, this is gonna be good.
This is penance.
Let it be known that I have spikes in my ass. I hurt so much.
Oh,
just be my powers.
I want you to hurt me.
Yeah, that was so gay.
Dude.
He was like, please punch me. Yo, dude.
The only thing I can think of when he spoke that line was, I want you to hurt me.
I want you to hurt me. I need you to hurt me.
Oh, God, it's going in the back.
You think? Jesus fucking Christ. We haven't even started the damn episode yet. We're already in the back.
Okay, so do you guys want to get the yelling out of the way now?
Oh,
tonight, we dine in McDonald's.
Would you like fries with that shake?
But I'm guessing everyone liked it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, do we have a dissenter among us?
No.
No?
No. And they will burn!
Wait, I have a dissenter, Alan Moore.
There you go.
Alan Moore.
Alan Moore didn't write this.
So what?
Yeah, what is the sound?
Yeah, so what, man? He hates everything.
I hate the sound of my own voice. I am Alan Moore.
Not yet, moron.
My only complaint was that David Wenham's voice just took me out of the moment towards the end.
It's that gravelly voice from that man. He kept talking and talking in his voice. He would not stop.
Because he's Batman.
He was on the toilet when he was recording the whole voiceover.
Because he's Batman, that's why.
That's a better voice than Batman that Christian Bale had.
Oh. Don't discount Bale like Batman.
No, I like Christian Bale. It's just not his Batman voice.
But I like his Batman voice.
Kind of weird.
I swear to God.
Swear to me.
Okay. Terrific.
That will go down in the ages as the best and worst Batman line ever spoken.
Yeah. No. Are you dead? Are you retarded? The goddamn Batman.
Okay, I want that in the next Batman movie.
I know.
I'm the goddamn Batman. And Frank Miller will go, yes, they brought it.
Frank Miller directed Batman movie.
Yeah, exactly. Nolan's going to back it up introducing Robin, and then Miller's going to do it.
God. Yeah, and
they're going to spend 3/4 of the movie in the goddamn car.
So Robin gets raped in the third act?
By a rat, and then Alfred gets pinch smacked. For the second part of this movie, tune in 2027.
No, it'll be an animated movie, and guess who's doing the animation? Jim Lee.
Okay, no, because that would be 5 minutes long.
It'd be 5 minutes long, it'd take 10 years to finish.
That's a sketch pad.
Well, that's what I love, it'll cut out, you won't have a chance to finish the full scene, it'll just be, I'm the goddamn Batman.
Exactly. Come back
it'll be next week.
It'll be animatics, it won't be full animated. You'll just have the black and white drawings.